Hello and a warm welcome to a completely new podcast, which is called Inside VC. And as the name obviously says, it's about venture capital. And we try to find an inside perspective. I'm speaking English. So what we're trying to do is have an international perspective. And I think I found a really great guy for this. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Christian Leibold. I'm a VC with eVentures. I'm super happy to be here with you, Joel. And we'll try and do our best and do this in English, as he says. And so we can get a lot of you guys to listen to this. I've been in VC since the end of 2002, so it makes me feel really old, actually, but it's been many years. Prior to that, I was an electrical engineer and worked in consulting for some time, and you know, at some point, crossed the line to VC and joined my colleagues in San Francisco, spent a couple of years there, then went back to Europe in around 2006. Couple of years in Europe again, we kind of started our operations here, and then recently I again spent 2 years in our San Francisco office and moved back last fall. So I've been kind of between both San Francisco and Europe for the time I've spent with eVentures.
In my brain, eVentures often was, you know, positioned as the VC from Otto, the e-commerce or commerce company from Hamburg. Is that true? I think it is not. I think you're much more than this, but maybe you give, say, like one or two lines about you guys, your sweet spot, and what you're into.
Been around as a team actually since the late 1990s, and then in 2008 started working with Otto, and you know, they became an anchor investor in our family of funds, so we have a very, very close relationship with them. But we invest in various geographies. We have many other limited partners, as we call our investors, and we certainly don't only invest in e-commerce or anything that would be related in any way to their business. So it's a much broader view, but there is a very strong relationship that I think is quite unique in venture capital that we've built with Otto and that we're very happy about and very proud of. But it's really, you know, not a limitation in any way. And you know, as a firm in general, we invest in consumer internet and software. We do that across the world, mostly from offices in San Francisco, from here in Germany, from Asia, where we're in Beijing and Tokyo, and also from Sao Paulo in Brazil. So we cover all those areas with teams on the ground, and we invest on the early stage side, probably going to talk more about that later, and also on the growth side with an international growth fund in, again, those sectors, consumer internet and software.
We have an international perspective and also from early stage to growth stage, which I think is really important. What I love to do is asking the people what are their ideas, their wishes, like why are they doing this? So what are your expectations doing this VC podcast? Like what happened in your mind when I wrote you an email and said, hey, Christian, how about doing a VC podcast?
What I find again and again, and this is especially true here in Europe, is there are a bunch of myths around VCs, and you know, they're kind of like, some people believe that sharks are nice compared to us. Yeah. So I think one of my goals, or what I found most interesting about doing that, is to be able to really give everyone a little bit of peek behind the scenes of our business. And I think that will hopefully reveal that it's a business like anyone, in the sense that you have to work hard to be successful. It's not like you're sitting behind a desk and just saying yes or no to business plans. That's not how you're going to be successful. And also at the same time, kind of bust a few of those myths that we're, you know, people who are just interested in taking control of companies or driving founders out of businesses or some of the other things that are often thought about when people think of VCs.
I would love to understand it more deeply. I realized when researching this thing here already that there's quite a few stuff. Also, for instance, from a regulation perspective, that no one knows outside the VC business, but that really plays a role. And as our first topic, we chose the topic of fundraising, as especially in Germany, like quite a few funds popped up right now, and I know that there are more coming. And this is why we focus on this topic, like how does fundraising work? What are the processes, the regulations? What do I need to know? Which players are involved, etc., etc. Maybe let's start by this from a perspective that is non-VC. Why does a VC, which is an investor, need further investors? Because when I raise a fund, the idea is getting investors. Could you explain that process?
We are a place that essentially aggregates money from various investors, then looks for ways to put that money to work by investing in individual startups. Think about it that the layer above us are a lot of different investors. We pool that money and then again distribute it or diversify it across a number of portfolio companies below. We're that, let's say, piece in the middle that is making the decisions as to where the money goes, and hopefully by making the right ones, create a portfolio that is going to be successful and making money that then again flows back up to our investors. So While as a management team, we put in a certain piece of the money. If you look at fund sizes that are typical, a bunch of general partners by themselves probably wouldn't be able to put that up. So our job is to convince our investors that we're doing a good job at investing that money in companies that are promising.
What is the amount of money a VC himself puts into that fund and the money that comes from external sources, these LPs, as they're named?
It varies quite a bit, and it depends typically on the fund size, because we always think about this as the partner commitment, and usually people think about it in terms of percentage of the full fund. So numbers that are common are anywhere between 1 and 5%. Historically, 2% was a very typical number. It's been moving up recently, but again, it depends on the fund size. If you have a small fund, it tends to be a higher percentage number. If it's a large fund, even 2% can be a very big absolute number. But that's roughly the range that you see in terms of the amount that partners themselves put into the fund in terms of having skin in the game, as we call it.
What is the process now? How do you manage to get LPs, limited partners, so the investors, your investors basically? What's the process? How do you find them? I mean, they do not run over the street and say, here is my money. So what does it look like?
Yeah, if you think about it, it's actually very much like a startup trying to raise money from VCs, right? Same here, the first time is always the hardest. Basically, you try and find out if you have a certain thesis of investing. Let's say you're strong in a certain area, you're strong in a certain vertical. You try and find out what are the limited partners, what are the fund investors that have invested in other funds that maybe have a similar focus. Then you try and find introductions to those and go talk to them, build a relationship. It's very much like a startup that's looking for the right VC. You go out and look for the right limited partners. And it can be, in the beginning, quite a difficult process, because you need to think about, what do they want to hear? How do I have to present my materials? How do I have to present the story? What's important about us as a team to kind of match the taste of the different types of investors that are out there? But it's really a business development effort, if you want.
What's the amount of people that need to invest? Like, what's the amount of LPs? I would guess it's at least around 100 to 200 people, right?
No, it's less usually. So it depends a little bit on the type of investor that you have, and that may also vary between first-time funds and those that have been around for multiple fund generations. But usually, if you think about it in typical scenarios, when you're raising from what we call institutional investors, so those could be, let's say, insurances, could be money managers of any kind, family offices even, let's say they will invest between 5 million and 10 million, that's a very typical check size, as we call it. And so if you're raising, let's say, a 100 million fund, you might end up with, you know, a dozen, two dozen maximum LPs. Historically, it's been more, let's say, in the dozens than certainly in the hundreds.
I had the impression that many German guys here, like, take 100,000 euro or 500,000,
yes,
put them in a fund, and it adds up in a way, right?
That's new. That's a relatively new phenomenon. If you look at the historical LP bases of especially US investors, they sometimes had what they called side funds for their entrepreneurs or, you know, other people that could provide valuable input, but they would typically not have individuals in the core fund. Usually the core fund is reserved for people who invest several millions and do so through some kind of structure, you know, some kind of institutional money management structure that has very different reasons that range from regulatory all the way to, you know, how many investors can you effectively communicate with and have a relationship with. But that's how it's traditionally been. The fact that, you know, now entrepreneurs are investing in funds is a relatively new phenomenon that you certainly see here, that to some extent also see in the US, but it's something that has popped up over the last, I would say, 3 to 5 years more and more.
How long does it take to get this thing rolling, right? I learned at least a year.
Yeah, it depends. If you're doing it for the first time, probably the variance is the greatest, right? Because you have to first come up with your story, figure out what types of investors you want to be talking to, where your story resonates, and then really do the roadshow, do the tour, build the relationships for the first time, meet people several times. You know, there, I think it can at least take a year. It may even take longer until you have found sort of the right angle. Then if you're doing it repeatedly and, you know, you're on your second fund, on your third fund, and you've done a good job, the process can be much faster because you're going back to people who already know you. That makes it a lot easier and a lot quicker. It still will take a few months by the time you've gone from the first meetings to actually signing paperwork, but it certainly is easier than at the very first time.
It's kind of a sales funnel in a way. Do you have some kind of thumb rule or statistics? How long does it take from meeting a potential LP in the very beginning and closing him?
It really depends very much on the type of LP. So I would say, you know, LPs really come in several buckets. Yeah, you have institutional investors that are purely financially driven. Those can be what we call fund of funds. So essentially funds that, again, invest in funds. They can be large endowments, especially in the United States, universities and so on have very big endowments that historically have always invested in venture. People like that, they very often have quite formalized processes where, let's say, a board meets in certain intervals to decide which allocations they're going to make. And that can be once a quarter. Sometimes it can be only once every 6 months. So there you're definitely looking at processes that take several months. Then you have more the category that we just talked about, you know, individuals, family offices, where essentially the decision maker is typically one person and you may actually be talking to that very person. That can be very quick. That can be, in an ideal case, one lunch meeting where you basically make a good pitch and he says, I'm in. We've had everything from, you know, several months to really literally a day, but then typically, of course, the amounts that get invested in those more institutional settings are larger. And the third category probably are corporates, which you also see increasingly investing. And there again, it depends on the governance. Public company will always take longer than a privately held company. Not always, but, you know, will have more processes and typically take longer than a privately held company where if you're talking to the right decision makers, things can actually be done relatively quickly. But it's definitely a few months.
I'm trying to imagine this, you know, this lunch thing where a VC sits in front of a really rich person or someone, you know, representing an institution or a corporate. How does this work? What's the sales pitch, basically? How do you manage to get the money, to get these people in? And
I can only speak for myself in that case, because I think everybody's got a little bit of a different style. I think at the end of the day, it's all about trust and credibility. And I think it's important that already before you have such meetings, you have communicated the basic facts. You've sent a presentation. You have given people the numbers. So they have the objective numbers of your track record. And only if those numbers look good, do they typically even spend the time with you. And then I think when you meet with people who have the ability to make a decision whether they want to invest a couple million or not, it's all about being authentic. There is little point in overselling or trying to promise something that you can't keep, because first of all, it's going to come back and haunt you later on. Second, I think quality of these people is usually such that they will sense that. So at the end of the day, I think it's being authentic, telling them exactly what you think you can do, why you can do it, and how you're committed to it. And then either it's something that interests them, that, you know, they buy into, or it's something that just isn't a fit. But usually being straightforward there is, in my sense, what works best.
Does age play a role, by the way? I mean, usually you would say the silver bag, the biggest monkey, the gorilla in the room, you know, gets all the attention, especially from the corporate guys. But yet being young and being able to you know, understand the way youth is thinking, because, you know, especially digital startups, digital topics really rely on young people. Does this play a role, like the age of someone that's raising?
It depends. It really depends on who you're talking to. I think, you know, there are people who are more numbers driven. They just look at, you know, what you've done in the past, and then age is probably not as important. There are people who are more relationship driven, and they will in fact either gravitate towards more senior, i.e. older people, in the sense of I trust experience, I want people who have been around this for a long time, or they'll gravitate towards I like young people who are going about this differently and who have potential, where I'm the first guy to find them, to fund them. That's going to be positive because I can build a strong relationship with them over time. So there you kind of have both extremes, really.
Being a VC is kind of having a business model in a way, right? So you have a hypothesis that you follow, you have experience in what you do. And what I ask myself today, is it necessary to have some kind of positioning in mind, like strategic position? For instance, Project A, for instance, is pretty much on this. We are an operational VC, meaning we give you money, but we also support you operationally wise. Or Point 9 in Germany is pretty much some kind of a niche VC. You know, their niche, I mean, it isn't that is that small niche, it's SaaS. It's actually pretty big, but they totally focus on SaaS. And when someone says, hey, who should I ask for money when I'm doing a SaaS business? They say Point 9. Is it necessary by now to have such hypotheses and strategic orientations if you want to raise money?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I think it's absolutely important to have a clear differentiation around what you're doing and what types of entrepreneurs would be a good fit for you and why they would probably like to work with you maybe more than with some others. That doesn't mean that you can't collaborate very successfully with other VCs, but I do think it's important to have a very clear value proposition. And if you look at us, actually, a lot of the deals we do are deals where we approach the companies. So I think the VC model is changing in the sense that actually very active VCs spend a lot of time going out looking for companies, approaching them, and telling them about how they can help. And that basically drives the need for a very clear story and very clear differentiation. It always sounds a little counterintuitive, but the way I look at it is I always say we're salespeople for money. We are trying to sell our money to the best entrepreneurs we can find, and therefore we have to provide things that go beyond the money. So I think absolutely having a clear positioning is critical today and will become only more critical as more VCs enter the market.
Yet VC is still an outlier business, at least in my opinion. In my view, I have the impression that it's sometimes more worthwhile to get the one big shot or maybe the two big shots that could save up a whole fund than, hey, I'm a really great, you know, in that business or the districts. Like, if outliers are this important, is strategy then really a factor in this case? I mean, in the end, it's just about identifying the one right guy or the one.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think our business would be so much easier if we knew ahead of time who would be the one right guy. The reality is, I think you build your reputation in the market across your entire portfolio. And that is what allows you to end up with a portfolio that has one or two or three stars in it. So I don't think if you look at it after the fact and say, oh, you know, it would have been enough to make those two deals. Why did they make all the other ones? You know, you're doing the work of a VC justice, because I think the reality is you don't know ahead of time. There is some luck involved, market timing. You just, with the best decision making in the world in venture, you can't know ahead of time. So I think what gets rewarded is constant effort and being a reliable partner to entrepreneurs, because then even the ones where it didn't work out will talk positively about you, and they may refer the one deal that ultimately ends up making your fund.
Let's say I'm an LP right now that has a lot of money and is interested in getting a foot into the door in the digital space. What I guess what they would ask you normally is, why shouldn't I do direct investments instead of giving you the money and have to pay all these different fees, etc., and do not have that much control? So if you say, like, investing in funds versus direct investments, what does make more sense from what perspective?
That's a very good question that I think a lot of people over the last couple of years answered in the sense of, why don't I do it directly, right? Why don't I invest in startups directly? I'm seeing deal flow myself. I think in reality, VC is the one asset class where an active manager with some level of experience is incredibly important, more so than in almost any other asset class. And that's because what we just discussed, the portfolio is going to be, the return of the portfolio is going to be driven by a very small number of individual companies. That's because of the high risk return ratio in venture. So first of all, you really need a significantly sized portfolio to have enough probability to have a couple of good winners in there. Second, you really need some experience in picking and building a reputation in a market. It's a very long-term market at the end of the day if you don't want to be gambling. So very few LPs are really able to make that many investments, to be that active in the entrepreneurial scene in order of building their own reputation and being approachable, that they could really support what it takes to build a venture portfolio that is long-term successful. So I think that's something that's much easier in a market where you're maybe deciding to do one or two deals a year, you're very, very late stage, you have a lot of data about the companies already. Maybe there, as an institutional investor, you can go direct. In venture, I think it's all about active management, building a portfolio, being in the market, and that's something that for LP, that's usually relative to its asset size, thinly staffed, it's very hard to do.
Even though it's called venture capital, it's basically about reducing risk in a way.
Absolutely. We're reducing risk, we're diversifying across your portfolio, and aside from the pure diversification, we're trying to, you know, add value and hopefully have people who over time have learned or, let's say, trained their eyes to find companies that are promising. In the Valley, they always say it takes $50 million to train a VC. Now, whether that number is higher or lower, I don't know, but it's true that...
I heard this number too.
certain things you can only learn by yourself. And we've all made mistakes, and those mistakes are very costly, very costly. But, you know, if you make them in a team, at least you can probably reduce the number a little bit. If you were to start off on your own, you have to be extremely smart and diligent in trying to go through this learning curve without wasting this money. And I wouldn't say wasting, it's actually just money that you pay for learning. And as a team, you can try and reduce that number somewhat, hopefully.
Now let's say it worked, like someone invested in you guys or in a fund in general. What does an LP normally expect from a VC?
So, I mean, first and foremost, financial return, right? I mean, and that it depends a little bit on the different type of investors, but, you know, especially financial investors, at the end of the day, it's only about return that you generate. There are various measures of return, how investors look at it. Usually there are three numbers. There is what's called an internal rate of return, which is essentially something that measures, you know, the interest that you generate on the capital. And then there are two numbers, one of which is called distribution to paid in capital, DPI, which shows or is an indicator for how much money have you actually given back to investors already from investments that you've sold or otherwise gotten liquid in relative to the money that's been put in. And there is a third number that's called TVPI, total value to paid in, which basically also accounts for companies that have had gains in book values or where book values have gone down, but then haven't been sold or liquidated in some other way yet. So if you look at venture numbers or metrics, usually it's these three numbers: IRR, usually on a net basis, so after all costs have been taken out, DPI and TVPI. That's what financial investors look for. Corporate investors are a little different in that corporates also look for some kind of strategic radar. They want to see what's going on. They want access to the ecosystem. And where it becomes interesting is if a VC, you can actually use that to your advantage as well, because the startups also like to get access to large corporates as pilot customers or otherwise. And so they're being a bit of a, you know, bridge is another aspect. But I think even there, good financial performance is what gets you through the door.
Let's do a little bit of expectation management. As you said, financials is one of the key factors. What can people expect? Taking a 100 million fund, which numbers should be given back in return?
The simplest way of looking at it is what we call cash on cash return. So how much essentially comes back, ideally after all the costs have been taken out. And expectations are very different. They vary wildly depending on geography and stage, because of course, in the more later stage funds, there is less risk. So you probably have a lower return, but it's a little bit more steady. In early stage, it fluctuates more. But given the risk that you're taking as an early stage venture investor, people probably want to see something like 3 times their money. And if you then take that and do the math for the VC, and let's take cost out for a moment so it becomes a little simpler. So things like management fee and so on, let's forget about that for a moment. And assume that you buy a 20% in every company that you invest in. So you own 20% for every company. Let's say you have a 100 million fund. You want to turn that into 300 million. If you own 20% of every company you sell, you have to sell companies worth 1.5 billion so that your 20% are worth 300 million and you get 3 times the 100 that you have invested. 100 million fund, 3 times return, forgetting about cost, 1.5 billion in return. So think about what that means if you have a 500 million fund or you have to invest in companies that collectively are worth 7.5 billion. So the numbers get very big very quickly. And that, again, comes back to why it's important to have a few outliers in there that help you get to those large numbers.
In the end, it shows it's pretty tough business. I mean, you need to find these guys. You need to, you know and invest into which ones in the later stage as well. So actually, that's really tough. I mean, also intellectually, which I think many people do not see yet.
Yeah, I think what's, you know, from the outside, it often looks like these guys just make a couple bets. And then people tend to interpret a few successful exits as they must be printing money. Because, of course, if you look at that particular company, you might have made 5 times, 10 times, 20 times your money. That's a great return. But then if you put that in the context of the portfolio, if there aren't a couple other winners, you know, the fund itself may not look that great. So it is not an easy business. And if you look at how many VCs are coming in and going out of business, of course, you have a lot of funds also that, you know, for many reasons don't raise follow-on funds. Very often it's performance. Sometimes it's a lack of managing generational change, but it can be any of those reasons.
Yeah, generational change is actually a really great topic. We should speak about that later on. But for the moment, maybe let's dive a little bit into terms before we go into regulation. You said already that there is stuff like a management fee, and I think there are some others. Let's explain them like really, really briefly and say what are the typical values here that are more or less normal. Maybe starting out with, as you said, management fee and carry, I would say, are the two main ones. And
the key metrics when you're raising a fund that people quickly ask about in terms of your economics as a partnership are, what's the management fee you take? So that is a fee that you take on a yearly basis. It's usually between 2 and 2.5 percentage points. And from that fee, which you take out of the fund volume or, you know, the commitment from your investors, you cover the ongoing cost of operating the funds, the salaries of your team, the rent of your offices, all that kind of stuff. That's the management fee, again, 2 to 2.5 percentage points, usually. The other thing is, if things go well and you generate a positive return for your investors, that means after you've returned the capital that they've put in and you're starting to generate a gain for them, as a management team, you're usually entitled to keeping a certain proportion of that gain. It's usually 20 to 25%. In some cases, it can be up to 30%. And that is what's called the carried interest. So if you make a multiple on the money that has been put in, you take, let's say, 20%, 25% out of that gain. And that's what's really, I think, driving the economics for venture capitalists.
Building on this, do VCs get a salary, by the way? I mean, as you said, management fee, obviously they do. But how high is it? From a startup perspective, I think this is really interesting. Like, how much does my investor earn each month?
That's a very good question, because it will vary widely. It will vary incredibly widely across different firms, because if you think about it, that percentage number, it doesn't move that much. Maybe it goes down to 1.5% or something like that, but the fund sizes can go up a lot. Very often, the amount of people that you need to operate those funds, of course, goes up as well, but it doesn't go up proportionally. So the larger your fund, the more is left at the end of the year, at the end of the day, for the partners to pay their salaries, if you want. The real answer is it varies wildly. It's difficult to put a number to it. But the more people you see on the website, the less it is. The smaller the investor team, the higher it likely is.
Obviously, it also differs regarding the role, whether you're an investment manager or a partner or whatever, but give us a brief idea.
It's really hard to answer, even though I would like to, because the compensation, much like in a startup, it's a combination then of what you get as cash salary and carried interest, which in a startup would be equity. This can vary a lot. Again, it also depends on the fund size. What I would say is this is a job where people do make good salaries, probably less than investment banking, probably less than in private equity, but nobody has to worry about their VC not being able to afford paying for lunch when he takes them out.
Okay, so startups should remember that. You talked about carried interest already. So basically, if I generate a certain amount of money out of the money I receive from my LPs, I'm allowed to take a part of it. And then there's also something which is called hurdle rate, which does play an important role. Maybe you could say one sentence about this one as well.
Yeah, hurdle rate is something that essentially makes sure that if you generate sort of a measly return, you know, a couple of percentage points per year, where people say, oh, gee, you know, I would have rather invested in, I don't know, some corporate bonds to get a similar return, that you don't start taking carried interest right away. So it means that before you enter the territory of getting this famous carried interest, you first have to cross a certain hurdle, which is usually a couple of percentage points a year. It can be 6, can be 8, something like that.
Okay, maybe one last sentence about terms. And then there's also this Keeman rule, which I learned, which basically means the team of VC should stay together.
Yeah, so essentially, if you're an investor putting money into a VC fund, the reason why you do this is because you believe in the ability of the team to make good investments. So you want to make sure that that team actually sticks around to invest your money and doesn't get swapped out or decides to leave and give the reins to somebody you don't like. So there is a Keyman clause, which means essentially that as an investor, you can stop giving money if the people that you have backed leave the firm. That's what a Keyman clause is. It's essentially an insurance against making sure that the partners that have raised the money don't leave the firm.
Are there other rights that LPs normally have? For instance, an insurance content-wise that you say, hey, I want you guys to be risky in a way, you know? Earn a lot of money, so do not do this risk-averse stuff. Or, I don't know, do not invest more money than this per deal. Or try to keep, you know, this much amount of money for later stage.
So it's relatively limited. I guess that's why they're called limited partners too, in the sense that the idea is you're backing a VC team, you're trusting them to do the right thing. There are certain rules, like let's say, for example, if you want to invest more than 10% of the fund into one single portfolio company, sometimes you need the approval of your limited partners for that. So things that are kind of like below the waterline decisions that are unusual and outside the scope of ordinary investment activity, you might need the approval of your limited partners. Other than that, it's really up to the management, up to the general partners, as we call the people who actually run the fund, to decide where they want to invest.
But are there any regulations that you should keep in mind as a VC? For instance, I had the impression that especially if you want US-American LPs, you have to think quite well about some stuff. As far as I learned, speaking publicly about raising money, for instance, is a problem in that case. What are the regulations?
Yeah, so there is a number of different regulatory frameworks that you have to adhere to. And most of the things that you have to watch out for are rules that are there to protect people who might want to invest in your fund. There is different levels of how investors are categorized, professional investors, semi-professional investors, and so on. And depending on who you talk to as potential investors in your fund, you need certain levels of regulatory compliance or regulatory registrations with, in Germany, the BaFin, for example, or in the United States, the SEC. So that's the first thing. Depending on the types of investors you talk to, you as a manager need to be regulated and need to be registered. The second thing is, if you're effectively selling your fund, you need certain clearances from the regulator to be doing so. So they must have okayed some of the materials that you provide to investors and so on, just in the framework of general protection of investors. So you can't go around and promise stuff or show information that just isn't true. And that way mislead people who might, based on that information, invest in your fund. The other little nit is that, especially in the United States, you need to be very careful with what is considered advertising your fund or selling your fund to potential investors. So, for example, you should not, while you're fundraising, make an announcement, for example, that you've had a first close of a fund, because that may be considered as trying to lure other investors to invest in your fund, which then is public fundraising, as opposed to only be talking to a select group of individuals privately and without making an offer that's public. So there are a lot of nuances that you actually have to understand, especially if you're talking to American investors, but even here in Europe, and that's only getting more and more.
I ask myself, okay, obviously doing PR calls the SEC to the plan, but yet when does it start to be publicly advertising something and when is it just speaking privately?
Think about a little bit like a quiet period that companies have prior to an IPO for VCs in the sense as well. So it's not quite as strict. I mean, you can be doing PR as a firm for your portfolio investments on all of that. The only thing you can't do is publicly tell people that you're now raising a fund that whoever is interested in may consider investing in. And usually making announcements of, hey, we're halfway or we're almost closed, are considered an offering. So it's really not that hard. You just need to make sure you're not making offerings in the wrong places or to the wrong people.
What about operational roles of VCs? Because if a VC starts becoming an operative supporter in a way, he has to pay much more taxes.
So that is a specifically German issue in that in Germany, or German funds are typically classified as asset managers. And as such, the amount of control they can have over the individual companies they invest in is extremely limited. And there are a number of criteria that are being tested for it to determine whether as a fund you qualify as asset manager or if you're actually an operating business. And operating business would mean you're operationally involved in the companies. That's something you just have to be aware of as a VC if you choose to have this asset manager status. And then there are different ways of still being able to support companies, even if you are an asset manager, by, for example, working closely with another company that, you know, can help the portfolio companies, but it's not inside the core scope of your fund. There are ways you can structure this, but it's effectively a German issue that fund managers based here need to be aware of.
Board seats are okay and helping with your network, but actually actively engaging is a problem.
Yes, that's right. And I think, you know, typically as a VC, you don't want to be making decisions for your portfolio company anyway. So I don't think it's really that much of a problem. And as you say, board seats are okay. And there is a lot of other things you can do. You just need to make sure that as an individual representing your fund, you don't exert too much influence over the company. But it essentially is something that's usually welcomed by entrepreneurs because they like the support, but they don't necessarily want the influence, or they want to be able to choose from the things you might suggest. The tricky thing is, if one of your companies fails that test, your entire fund fails that test. This test for asset manager versus being a business. So you really need to be careful with every single company.
And also historically, right? So you need to do this for every company you invested
in. It's always viewed at typically on a per fund basis, but absolutely. So it has quite important implications.
Are there other big mistakes a VC can do from a regulation perspective?
Oh, I'm sure there is a lot of mistakes. I mean, well, the first big mistake is, of course, about where you put your money, right? I mean, you know, backing the right type of companies, that's what we call the picking, and that's obviously the most important. But
that's not regulation.
Right. And, you know, in terms of operating a fund, I think the biggest thing is to really be a reliable partner over time. In my mind, the almost biggest mistake that you can make as a VC in terms of if you want to be around for the long term is being very jumpy. So you jump from field to field, you change your strategy, you change the type of companies you back, you are a hassle to entrepreneurs because you have a short attention span. You go in one day, say this, go in another day, say that, are not reachable the third day. I think that's the biggest problem. So I think the biggest mistake is not being disciplined and not being reachable and not being in for the long run with a strategy that, of course, you keep adapting, but that is consistent over time.
This is actually also about signaling in a way. As far as I learned in Berlin, founders really start to think of signaling. Like, what effect does it have if I choose this or that VC? What do other people think of it? And I think I could imagine that a VC has the same problem. And the aspect you just mentioned is one of it. Is there other stuff you need to keep in mind to avoid negative signaling when raising a fund?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think there is a number of things you want to look for. I mean, first of all, you don't want to have a perception in the market that you've been out there raising for a long time. You don't have a fund anymore that you can invest from, right? Where the investment period has lapsed and you're what we call running dry. You always want to make sure you're early enough in the fundraising cycle so that you can close a new fund before your old one kind of runs out on its what we call investment period. So the time during which you can commit to new investments. I think that's really important that the timing is right. Then the other aspect is that you don't want to be spreading your materials to all the investors you can find. If people get the impression that you're flooding the market with your proposals and everybody is looking at a particular fund, it doesn't make it feel like it's a very coveted opportunity that is exclusive and that's strong. I think really getting timing and the target group that you're talking to right are probably the two most important factors in making sure you get a successful fundraise.
Later on, you also spoke about getting the generation shift done in a way. I learned that one negative aspect from a signaling perspective is when you close a new fund and shortly before or shortly after it, name a new partner. Yet on the other hand, it's really, really important to get this shift done because quite a few German funds died out basically because they didn't manage this. So what is your view on this whole generation thing?
The scenario that you're probably alluding to is what happens if a certain team goes out fundraising, they find they're not successful because the criticism is, look, guys, you need to bring in some additional people. And then as a reaction to that, they bring in somebody, make an announcement, say, oh, now we're new and redesigned, right? And we're kind of going back to the market of investors with an improved proposition. And that, I think, is challenging because it feels like you're kind of fixing the car while you drive, right? What is common, however, is that when you have a new fund, then you bring on new partners, which, full disclosure, is something we've just done. But the reason you want to do it as early as you can, actually, is because you want to give the new team time to gel and build track record together, so that by the time a couple of years down the road you raise the next fund, doesn't look like you've just brought somebody on to help the fundraising, but you've already proven that you can work well together as a team over several years, that you can make good investment decisions together, and that it really works. And so that's why usually you rather bring in new people towards the beginning of a fund, where it's a move that shows you want to grow, you want to broaden your market presence, as opposed to towards the end of an investment period.
Let's speak about incentives in that respect. Obviously, a generation shift is really, really important, yet it does mean for the elderly VCs, or the ones being in the business for quite a while, that the management fee and the carry are shared with more people. What does it look like if a VC tries to create incentives for younger partners?
So essentially, it's called sharing, right? It's called sharing. And so that's why a lot of people actually do have a tough time with it. I think the reality is, though, that if you bring in the right people, in the long term, it's going to make your firm much more successful, which doesn't necessarily result in raising larger funds, because that, if you go back to the earlier point in terms of how much capital you need to return to produce a good return, may make it difficult for your strategy to still work. If you have an early stage strategy, you can't have your funds arbitrarily big. However, if a team that is strengthened finds better deals and you create better return and more carried interest that way, even if you've shared it among more people, you might get out more in absolute dollars or euros. So yes, you have to be willing to share, but I think it's like always when you're building a team, if you bring in great people, the net effect is always positive.
Is it typical, by the way, or is it a usual process to build some kind of management holding above different funds? Like, I mean, if you, let's say you create three of them over 15 years or something. So is it typical to build some kind of management holding above it, where all the carry goes to, which then would afford these young partners to be a part of this management holding, or does it happen fund by fund?
So it's a few different things. So you typically have a management company that you also need for legal reasons, because it's the manager of the fund. The manager of the fund is usually a company that's owned by the partners as opposed to individuals, right? So you need to have this management company as a, let's say, legal person, and that can manage several funds over time, right? So as you raise new funds, they kind of get attached to that same management company. And then there are different models for allocating the carry. It can be done proportionally to holdings in that management company. It can be separate on a fund-by-fund basis. Everybody's got a slightly different model there. Simply what's important is that you provide a clear path for new people coming into the team, how they can grow ultimately into a level that's equal to the existing partners. I think long-term, the most successful partnerships are always those that are equal partnerships, because that puts you in a position where you don't need to constantly say, I'm a little better here, I'm a little worse there. You stop comparing, you just say, we all respect each other, we're equal partners. And so the corollary to that is you have to provide new entrants, even though if it's a very long path, but a clear perspective as to how they can ultimately get there.
By the way, from a perspective of a limited partner, is it a relevant danger that it might happen to him that the VC, you know, celebrates a big party from his management fee, just throws his money in the market with, you know, just spray and pray, and yet the business in the end looks okay or does not? But is this, you know, living from the management fee, is this a problem in the case?
If you think about it, the much bigger incentive is the carried interest. And second, you know, even if you were to just kind of invest in random companies and bank on the management fee, at least you still have to stick around. There is, you know, a vesting that usually goes over the entire life of the fund, which is usually 10 years. And so you can't just kind of party and then see the money coming in. So you do have to work actively with your company, support them to kind of be operating the fund. And really, while theoretically possible, it's just completely against the incentives, because the big carrot for the fund manager is always the carry. And if you ever want to be in a position to raise a follow-on fund and really build a platform, really build a firm, if you don't deliver, you know, that's going to be your last fund. Our business is very simple. People look at numbers. It's very easy to judge us because you just look at these three numbers that I mentioned and you show me a sheet, a portfolio sheet of a certain VC or those couple numbers. I can tell you, and anyone who's been in the business for a while, I can tell you relatively quickly how the performance looks like. So from that perspective, it's very simple to eliminate the ones that have not performed.
As you say, 10 years is usually the amount of time a fund is running. And what I ask myself is, also from an entrepreneur's perspective, what changes over time? Because in my experience, it does make a difference if you ask a VC for money when he is in his second to third or fourth year of a fund, or if he's in his eighth, ninth, whatever. At the beginning, he invests quite differently, I would say, than he does in the end. These, I think, last shots is what you call it. What happens over time with the fund?
So ideally, if a VC manages his business well, you don't even notice a difference, right? You don't even know the difference because they constantly have a fund that's in the investment phase. When one kind of gets close to the end, they get the next one at the ready. So you don't really notice a difference. What you find sometimes is that towards the end of the investment phase, which typically is 5 years, people tend to look for later stage deals where they expect an exit to come more quickly than if you invest at the beginning of the fund. Because after the 5-year investment period, you have another 5 years, which you could call, you know, the period in which the company is mature. And so if you're making an investment in year 5 into a very early stage business, the question is, does the company have enough time to really grow and become very successful and not put you under pressure to sell your stake earlier than you would like to? Because the reality is, very often the most successful companies are the ones you sell the latest, because you want to ride the value creation for a long time. And so that's why sometimes towards the end of the investment period, people are a little more conservative or skew later stage than in the very beginning.
Well, what about reserves then? I mean, if you do an investment at the very beginning of a fund, do you also plan with reserves for each company?
Yes. So that's an extremely important practice where you have to basically allocate additional funds for each investment that you make. So let's say you invest $2 million in a company at Series A stage, you have to assume that people are going to look to you for putting what we call pro rata, so an amount that helps you keep your shareholding at the same level by investing again in future rounds. You have to allocate money for that. And typically it's at least the same amount as the one that you invested initially. So you really need to make sure that you don't build a portfolio where suddenly out of, let's say, 100 million, you've invested 70 million, 80 million, and then there are all these follow-on rounds and you cannot put any more money, because that, coming back to signaling, is usually a poor sign and shows that either as a VC, you're in a weak position or you don't really believe in the company. Both of those are very bad signals. And what's important to note, it's tricky to make what we call cross-fund investments. So if you have one fund, you made the initial investment from that fund. Even after the investment period in the second 5 years, you can still invest in the companies that are already in your portfolio, do follow-on financings. And you, however, have to make it from the same fund. If you go cross-fund, it's tricky because the next fund might have different investors and there may be conflicts of interest between an early stage investment in a particular company and a later stage investment.
So what is the ratio typically then? Like reserves to investment?
Decent rule of thumb is to usually reserve the same amount for every investment that you do. Then there is, you know, unfortunately going to be a couple of companies where you don't follow on invest just because, you know, things aren't working out. So in reality, you're allocating more than the identical amount, more probably like 1.5 times or something like that than you have invested initially. And that, you know, tends to be a decent rule of thumb.
By the way, what changes if you compare early stage investments to later stage or growth investments? What changes in fundraising regarding these two points of view?
When you think about early stage, it's very much about identifying teams that have potential. And you have to prove that you're good at betting on teams when the information is still very incomplete. So you don't know how they're really going to develop. You make a bet, it turns out right. That's how you succeed in early stage growth. is much more disciplined in the sense of it's more about looking at data. You have certain data points, you have to read them the right way, interpret them in the right way, pay the right valuation, and that way make a multiple that's smaller than Innventure on average, but also less risky. So you don't want to have write-offs in growth. Therefore, when you're fundraising, also the way you present your team, your investment thesis on the early stage side are probably more based on these are areas where I believe in, and this is how in the past we've identified category winners in those areas early, before the category had a big name, before it was clear how things would play out. Whereas in growth, you really focus much more on the numbers and you show people your track record and how you've put money at the right price at the right time and achieved a certain return that is relatively consistent across the portfolio that you've built.
Does this consequently mean that it's easier to raise a growth fund than an early stage fund as long as your portfolio does look pretty okay?
The reality is, of course, that in growth, then you have a lot of competition because there is a lot of players out there on the growth side. That drives up valuations. So to right price a good portfolio on the growth side, I think also is not easy at all. I think, you know, there is no free lunch on either side. It's, if you want to do it well, it's hard work both for early stage and for growth.
The kickoff moment for us a bit to speak about fundraising in general was that it happened a lot in Berlin and Europe these days. What does the situation look like right now? I always had the impression that VCs are in a way, you know, contrahents enemies kind of, but yet I learned in Germany they aren't that much because they say, hey, the space is yet underdelivered, like we still need money and actually each of us has his own niche in a way, so we do more cooperate than fight against each other. In general, we are really, really happy if a new VC comes up because this helps build up the market. Does it look like this or is it more like competitive?
I absolutely think it's more cooperative than competitive. I actually, you know, when you compare to Silicon Valley, if people say there's competition here, I think it's a joke because in the Valley, you often have companies that have, you know, a dozen term sheets if they're strong, or they could, you know, at least get that many or even more. Whereas here in Europe, a deal is considered competitive if there is two competing term sheets. It's just a very different scale. You tend to have much more time here to look at deals than in the US. And I think there is plenty of room to cooperate, especially because here in Europe, follow-on financing is still one of the biggest risk factors. So once you've invested, unless the business is going through the roof, finding the right investor to do the Series B is quite some work. And you still need somebody who believes in the company. That person is much harder to find if there are very few VCs on whose doors you can knock, as opposed to a place where, like Silicon Valley, where you go up and down Sandal Road or certain streets in San Francisco and you have, you know, dozens of people who can invest. So I still think that it's good that there are more VCs being founded, that there is more funds that are going live, and we can all happily coexist because the rate at which companies are being founded and the rate at which the entrepreneurial ecosystem is growing, I think still outpaces the rate at which the venture ecosystem is growing here, at least locally, which is why you have so many international VCs coming in. So I think there is plenty of room.
Do you have an explanation why the competition from abroad isn't that big yet? I mean, I have been to Israel, and Israeli VCs do not that much deals in Germany, at least as far as I know. Yeah, I was talking to these guys and said, yeah, we do not have any portfolio in Germany. Basically, we go to the US and invest in the US. So I tend to ask myself, I see people coming from London quite a bit, and a few of them from the US, but that's basically it. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I do not see the full picture, but so far it seems that the competition from abroad is rather small.
If you say competition, I would agree with you again, 100%. I think, however, if you look at it from a different perspective, you know, if you had checked 5 years ago, if there was an American VC coming to Berlin, he was essentially a celebrity, right?
So I would say he still is.
Right, but less so, less so. And I think the fact that you have international VCs investing here at all at a reasonable frequency is already a big achievement. So I would look at it more from the perspective of the glass is half full and it's growing and it's good that it's growing, as opposed to a perspective of there is not much happening. I think that would be unfair because an entrepreneurial ecosystem needs time to grow. It needs time for companies to develop and, you know, investment opportunities to crystallize, especially at the later stage. And I think we're on a great trajectory here in Germany and in Europe in general across various sectors. And so I believe it's only going to get more, and it's the pace at which it's happening is absolutely encouraging.
As you've spent quite some time in San Francisco and the Valley, is there something that a German VC can learn from his US counterparts when it comes to fundraising?
Well, I think fundamentally, our American colleagues are usually just great at presenting and selling their value proposition. It's just something that, you know, I had some of my kids go to school in the US and I was amazed how early that process starts in terms of, you know, standing up in front of class and presenting something. That's just something where in Europe we tend to be much weaker. And if you look at the presentations of companies and VCs probably from here versus those of West Coast-based firms, there is a big difference. So I think the one thing that we can probably learn as VCs is just being smart about how we present ourselves, how we present our own strength, and maybe not being too modest, while at the same time, as I said initially, staying authentic and staying true to what you are without overselling or overpromising.
Great. Thanks a lot for taking so much time and explaining this topic to us. I guess we both are happy if people comment on like further topics that we should discuss. And yeah, so far, I think we were pretty much inside VC, and more to come. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. You're welcome.